Hello, and a very warm welcome to the Studio Canal Presents podcast. My name is Simon Brew from Film Stories magazine, and this is a regular podcast celebrating one of the biggest and deepest film libraries in the world. Studio Canal's extensive library of over 6,000 films brings together cinema from around the globe. There's lashings of horror with the likes of Evil Dead 2 and the legendary Don't Look Now, acclaimed modern dramas such as Supernova and Another Round, and international favourites including Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown and The Wave. We're going to be doing our best to explore it all in this podcast. This time, we're looking towards animation, in particular Marjane Satrapi and Vincent Parrineau's Oscar-nominated 2007 feature Persepolis. For the conversation, I'm going to be joined by film, TV and culture critic Campbell A. Campbell. But before that, let's set things up with a clip from the film.
Margie, look at you. You're all grown up.
You brought me a present, I hope. How was Paris? Did you see Bruce Lee? What's the Eiffel Tower like?
Welcome to Tehran, my dear.
We all missed you so much.
Let me take you back.
No, I'll do it.
Well, get going. Don't keep everyone waiting.
I remember. I led an uneventful, peaceful existence back then. The life of an average little girl. I loved eating french fries with ketchup. Bruce Lee was my idol. I wore Adidas sneakers and had two major obsessions. Being able to shave my legs one day and becoming the last prophet in the galaxy.
Campbell A., a very big welcome to the Studio Canal podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Now you're settled in the comfy chair, we like with our guests just to get a little film fact off them before we get going. A film that's particularly important to you, maybe one of the earliest you remember. Anything that springs to mind?
I feel like I should go with one of the earliest examples of traditional animation that I can think of. Any animation, the first thing I probably watch was Toy Story like everybody else. But one that has kind of stuck with me is Spirited Away by Hayao Miyazaki.
Oh, what a film.
I remember getting that on VHS not long after it won the Oscar, I think.
Yeah.
And not long after I watched Spirited Away, I got lost in a shopping centre. So it resonated very strongly with me.
Two things. Number one, you're way too young for VHS tapes, but total respect there.
Ah,
and number two, you go from Spirited Away to getting lost in a shopping centre.
A little bit traumatic.
A little bit, I understand.
It was okay. Terrifying, but it also meant that I was not afraid to go and ask someone for help because I was like, I don't want to end up stuck somewhere.
I mean, we're here primarily to talk about Persepolis. Can you set that up for us? Can you tell us how it came into your life and just explain a little bit about the film?
I first came across Persepolis in graphic novel form when I was at university. And I read a lot of comics, and I feel like the first thing that people think of when they think of comic books is superheroes, obviously, and you get kind of these bright, bold, like pop art kind of things. Persepolis is immediately a sort of counterpoint to all of that. It's working in black and white. It's autobiography, essentially, which I had sort of read in graphic novel form before with things like Hellraisers, a book that my dad gave me, a thing about Peter O'Toole in Hollywood,
Quality parenting.
And I'd read things like Brian Lee O'Malley's Scott Pilgrim. So like black and white comics wasn't like, oh my God, I didn't know they could do this kind of thing. But Persepolis is striking to me because I hadn't read a comic book that was so wrapped up in the history of a nation as well as its author.
Yeah.
So it had some real world bite to it that really stuck with me, as well as this kind of graphic stylings. So that immediately stood out to me. And then when I learned that it had a film adaptation, I kind of went straight to it because I was really interested to see how it would work on the screen. And then I was very surprised by how well it translated.
I mean, you touched on there one of the extraordinary things about Persepolis, about these twin narratives effectively through it, the history of a nation and the history of the author of the story. Can you take us into those a little bit and just explain those two narratives, how they come together?
The book is about Marjane Satrapi when she was a child living in Tehran, but it was during sort of time of upheaval, I think the Islamic Revolution, and the current ruler of Iran was the Shah, who had sort of taken on more right-wing policies are following like an attempted communist revolution, and was also sort of in the pocket of the British because the British wanted oil and were basically interfering both in Iran and in Iraq. But Satrapi specifically has ties to the old government because her grandfather was a prince who was then deposed and had all of his worldly possessions taken from him, grew up poor, and then became a communist. But this is also while he was prime minister, but then he got kind of ousted as well. So her family are very kind of revolutionary in their thinking, like an artist's family in a country that is sort of tightening its grip on free speech at the time. We see this all from like a child's perspective. In the book, she's looking back quite diaristically, so it's all with the benefit of hindsight. In the film, it's a bit more experiential, so we're seeing things happen as she experiences them. Her family is kind of closely tied to the history of the country and a history of like political upheaval, and then it sort of tells her biography growing up in the country and leaving it and coming back while there's various periods of upheaval.
It can also just be seen as a history of the country itself as well, history of Iran.
Yes, I think so. Maybe in a more vague sense than in the book. As with a lot of adaptations from page to screen, there's a lot more room for sort of historical detail on the page. There's a lot of little cutout narration boxes that are explaining context very thoroughly, and whole pages dedicated to little infographics about things that have happened and things that her father is telling her about. But in the film, they have to cut it down to like the bare essentials. But otherwise, yes, like a sort of rough history of the region.
I found it fascinating that Marjan Satrapi hadn't just penned the book of this, the graphic novel of this, but she's basically co-directing and co-writing her own biopic. I just wonder what the story meetings must have been on a film like this. What happens when like someone in a story meeting says, did it really happen like that? And then the subject of the film is in the room. I mean, that's unusual in itself.
Yeah, her co-director, Vincent, was on the project from the very beginning. So I think there was kind of a base understanding of what was real and what they sort of massaged for the film. I watched making of documentaries in preparation for this. She was saying about how Vincent kind of, she was like 50% of him is in this film. Like there's a lot of sequences that That's weren't in the book that came about because of their collaboration. So I feel like it was more like she was a grounding presence to the film than everyone sort of being in awe of what happened to her, because she talks about it wanting it to be in black and white. And it has to be animation. I never want this to be a live action film, because she wanted this sort of essential approach to the visuals to make it feel more universal. She was saying something that reminded me of a theorist called Scott McCloud. He's a comic book artist who talks about the importance of the icon and stuff. And he's saying like simpler is more expressive. And she's basically talking about that in regards to Persepolis's look.
We'd not really overtly address this, that Persepolis is an animated film.
Yes.
And it seems to me a firm rebuttal of two cliches, that animation is for kids and animation in itself is a genre. And I remember when this came out, and it did just kind of feel like a rocket out of left field, really, that it was so unusual at that point to have an inverted commas adult animated film. Do you think that films like this are still a bit of a novelty?
Maybe less so. I think perhaps 2D traditional animated movies are more of a novelty than adult ones, especially in European productions. I feel like you get a lot of breadth in terms of the kind of films that are being made. But it's definitely not a unicorn, but definitely a rare breed, I think, especially with this kind of story, which is very pointed and very political. A lot of the time when you get adult animation, I feel like it's pointed more towards like more harshly worded comedy or something more violent.
Yeah.
Whereas this is more interested in telling a story with a lot of real world significance and real world tragedy. But it's not dark. It's very light, I think, in a way that makes it feel even more unique.
I mean, the tone of it I found absolutely fascinating, because very early on we get smoking, we get boobs, we get casual sounding conversations about torture, then we get a bit of ABBA, then we get an amazing rendition of Eye of the Tiger from Rocky III. It's a really unusual tonal cocktail on this, and I think what also for me I found quite arresting was a lot of the matter-of-fact very dark conversations were coming through the voice of a very young character.
And whoever loses will be tortured to death.
Good idea, that's cool.
We torture him with what?
Whoever loses will get whipped on the head with an electrical cord. But before that, he'll have to put this in his mouth and chew it 3 times, all right?
Yeah!
Did you see that, guys? It's Ramin. Farzad said his cousin said Ramin's father worked for the Shah Secret Service. Which means his father killed 1 million innocent people with his own bare hands.
1 million?
Absolutely. In the name of those killed, we are going to teach Ramin a lesson.
I had quite a reaction to that. What kind of response did you have to it when you were, first of all, reading it and then watching the film?
It's a different experience reading it, as I said before, because when you're reading it, you sense that it's from the perspective of an adult writing down their biography.
Yeah, yeah, because I didn't get that from the film at all.
Yes, and it's so different in the film where it's, you're experiencing it through a child's eyes. But one thing that says to me is that the whole animation is for children conversation is one that also doesn't take the perspective of children seriously. When people say like, oh, it's for kids, they're talking about it in a sort of frivolous sense, like the viewpoints of children don't matter. And in this, even as a more adult film, it's kind of about emotional processes that a child can go through when reacting to quite extreme emotional circumstances. Like, she has a fairly basic understanding of what's happening around her at first, but then you kind of see her learning and we learn with her. And I think it's like a rebuttal on many levels to that concept to me. But that's what I'm struck by now. In the past, I was struck by how frank it was about the violence that Marjan witnessed.
I mean, yeah, I wonder if this is one of those instances where having the subject of the story in the room allowed it to balance that tone against the seriousness and the heaviness of what was being talked about.
I reckon that's definitely the case. I feel like a lot of the comedy in it is it's got this gallows humour to it.
Yeah,
that I feel
and it's
like
very funny, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, I wasn't expecting that.
You mentioned the Eye of the Tiger sequence already, which in...
Are you going to reenact it for us?
I'm not sure we have the... the Eye of the Tiger sequence is, I think, one panel in the comic book where she's sort of getting back on the horse and she's become an aerobics instructor, and it's kind of just blasting in a little speech bubble in the corner, whereas they turn it into this whole incredible montage in the film, which is just being sung, let's say to passionate effect by the actress.
Rising up, back on the street, if my time, took my chances. Went a distance, now I'm back on my feet. Just a man and his will to survive. It's the eye of the tiger, is the thrill of the fight. Rising up to the challenge of a rival. And the last known survivor stalks his prey in the night. And he's watching us all in the eye of the tiger.
I don't know if you watched the film in French or in English.
I mean, this is the debate, isn't it? Because by the letter of how you're supposed to do these things, you go with the original French language.
Mm.
But also, I found this a lot of Studio Ghibli stuff as well. The voice cast for the dub version is extraordinary. I was halfway through the dub version before I realised, hang on, I should be watching this in French.
I watched the English dub because
I thought it was great.
Same actresses.
Yeah.
And in some cases, so I was going to say, there's no wonder you mistook one for the other at one point.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's the same voices. But I'm kind of I'm agnostic on the whole dub versus original language one, because I think both have their uses in that maybe I could focus on the imagery a little bit more when I'm not having to read subtitles. But that's all beside the point. I just think the cast is really incredible. I feel like some decisions were really out of left field. Like, you had Iggy Pop as her uncle, which was wild. I imagine very...
Entirely logical.
I imagine very gratifying for Marjan as someone who has... this whole film's about her being raised on, like, Western counterculture.
Yeah.
So it must be very surreal to have a figure of that playing a relative.
You know, you coming here is a great honor for me. You're the daughter I always dreamed I would have. But don't you worry. One day soon, the proletariat will triumph. Here, I made you another swan from bread. It's the uncle of the first swan. Oh, my shining star.
I mean, the other thing that struck me watching it as well was the pace of it. Now, you're sat here by a copy of the graphic novel.
Yes.
And you've talked about the differences already, but, I mean, the graphic novel is thick and the film is quite lean. It's, what, 90, 91 minutes, something around that area. But the speed of the storytelling I found really quite surprising. You know, it gets through a hell of a lot in quite a short running time.
Yeah, it's pretty breezy, which is a funny thing to say about a film which contains 20 years of political history.
Well, that was the paradox in my head, really. I mean, it covers so much time.
Yeah, I don't want to turn this completely into the film versus the book conversation, but it is, again, it's taking a lot of the essentials, and I think it streamlines it in a very satisfying way. I guess just focusing in on Marjan as a character and how she relates to the backdrop that she's living in. And I guess having it be a bit more reactive than a very comprehensive biography makes it feel like quite fast-paced. So you're processing everything, but it's through her perspective.
Yeah.
And I think that makes it a bit more efficient. Like, you can get into this whole arc about being an expatriate as a person of colour, and sort of the, like, supposedly moving to a more enlightened place and still experiencing racism.
Yeah.
And I think the film captures that really efficiently, but not without cutting out, you know, what the sort of emotional angle of it. It's not just like they're racist in Austria and then moves on. It's, I think they have this very deliberate pacing, which I think just really worked for me, I guess, by focusing in on her rather than just trying to encompass everything. It's very about, much about her perspective.
And then you find yourself it going from something deathly serious to a dissection of the Bee Gees.
Yes.
Which I don't think I've ever watched a film that's been as critical as the Bee Gees before. It wasn't, again, it just subverted completely my expectation of what I was going to get from the film.
I really liked its use of pop culture when it's sort of her finding how to be expressive and rebellious when the country was kind of clamping down on women's dress codes, and she goes out to get some bootleg tapes and she's got the Punk Is Not Dead jacket on and she's and the Michael Jackson stuff. It's a very interesting perspective on pop culture and I think the power that it can contain.
Mom, come on, you have to give me 50 tomans.
Calm down. What for, honey?
Gonlas told me some guys are selling cassettes on Gandhi Avenue.
And your Bee Gees tapes?
Mom, the Bee Gees are totally lame.
Stevie Wonder.
Julio Iglesias.
Pink Floyd. Jackal Maxson.
I mean, there's a moment near the end that really struck me as well when they're in the lecture hall where she calls out the differing perspectives and the differing expectations between men and women and how they present themselves.
You say that our veils are too short, that our pants are indecent, that we wear makeup, etc., etc. As an art student, most of my time is spent in the workshop. In order to draw, I need to be able to move freely. A longer headscarf would make it all the more difficult. You also criticize us for wearing wide leg pants, even though they hide our curves effectively. But knowing these pants are in style right now, I pose a question. Is religion concerned with protecting our modesty, or is it just opposed to fashion?
It's kind of a film where I didn't quite know what was round the corner, and then it just finds moments to do stuff like that in a very striking and powerful way.
Yeah, a bit of a Stranger Than Fiction situation going on. I was thinking of like an animated docudrama, Flea, from a couple of years ago. I found myself thinking of that a little bit while rewatching this. But I think what this is doing differently is, I mean, one, it hasn't got the interview element of it, but I think this is a lot more visually expressive as well. Whereas Flea is like, it's built around a sort of design sense of realism. It's all like, even though it's quite cartoonish, I think what's special about Persepolis is that it's taking all of these elements of the pop culture she experienced and this historical worldview and just like pushing it into the frame through how the characters move and how the scenes are composed. Things like the two women telling her off about the aforementioned bootleg tapes, and they sort of turn into these weird, like, snake-like creatures. And I think, going back to your question about pacing, I think that's why this film feels so efficient, is that it's getting across these ideas so strongly just in what it's doing on the page.
And then also, we should touch on the animation style as well. I mean, you talked about it being in black and white. A couple of moments are of colour in the film as well. But I mean, the animation style feels deliberately stripped down, obviously reflecting in the comic book. I know this because I flicked through the comic book as you just brought it in. But also, it's stuff like that that makes me pay real attention to things like the eyes of the characters. Mm. And I just wonder, can you just take us into that a little bit?
The thing about this that I think made it stand out was that it's not just 2D animation, but pencil on paper.
Yeah.
And ink on paper. This is at a time where even a lot of the kind of studios versed in a lot of traditional animation were moving into digital hand-drawn.
Yeah.
Marjan speaks about kind of resurrecting sort of like very minor techniques in production, like tracing. It was all done on pencil on paper, but then what they did is that they traced over every single drawing with a felt tip pen, and that's how you have the very thick, defined lines. It feels like such a small thing, but a thing that sets this film apart from other animated films is just seeing the texture of the paper.
Yeah, yeah.
And how you were saying, like, you've got these very clear lines. That's, I feel like, a very French cartoon thing, like the Ligne Claire tradition of drawing. I think Persepolis has this way of drawing your eye to the things that matters. And I guess that comes from, well, they talk quite openly about it, because working in black and white, you have to be very considerate of what's in the background and what you're drawing your eye to in the frame. And I think that naturally comes across here. And especially when the cartoons are so sort of stripped down to their essentials and very simple.
The ink on the page thing I find really interesting. I spoke to a really experienced Disney animator once about the move to computers. And he said to me, the thing about a computer is it's like a secondhand car lot. It'll always sell you what it wants to sell you rather than what you want to give it. And by cutting that out of it, it's quite pure what they've put down on the page then.
It feels very human.
Yeah, yeah.
In the imperfections that are in its background drawings, like I liked that even though all of the characters have these very elegant, like, unbroken lines to them, all the buildings are kind of like wonky, like a little bit childlike. So I guess that sort of reflects that it's a sort of retrospective looking back without the narration directly addressing it, which is, again, it all comes back to this sort of efficient visual storytelling. Like, you kind of get this feeling without them having to kind of directly tell you about it.
Persepolis's reputation just seems to have endured in, what, the 15 years since it's come out?
Yeah, I suppose that speaks to it being very one of a kind, not just in terms of subject matter, but stylistically as well.
Yeah.
You don't see a lot of black and white animated films.
Yeah.
In terms of the reception to it, I was looking at the Oscar nominations for that year, and it was maybe only two other nominees, and now I'm blanking on which ones they were, but I think one of them was, like, Surf's Up.
It's not a bad film, Surf's Up.
Yeah, but I think...
I won't take a bullet for it, but...
Yeah. I'm not, yeah, not... You don't have to die on that hill, but it's, yeah, you can see the kind of environment that it's coming out in, and I imagine in an environment where there is kind of a persistent, not just Islamophobia, but a general hostility towards people from the Middle East.
Yeah.
And for a film to talk so frankly about American and British intervention in the region, not like in the film and in the book, I imagine ruffled some feathers, but I think that needed to happen because I think one of the things about this film is that it's very attentive to the conflicting ideologies in her country at the time and in the past. And I think a lot of the time when people talk about Iran or Iraq, it gets homogenized into one thing or the other. And people often forget that it is because of intervention from the British and the Americans that things went the way that they did.
Yeah.
And to have a film that, I guess, at first glance, voters might assume to be for children, to talk so openly about this culpability is very striking.
France submitted it that year for its entry for the best film not in the English language.
Well, I've always thought of that category as a sort of pigeonhole for,
yes,
not just for things like Best Picture, but also for things like production design. I would have put this up against anything else coming up that year because I think it looks really beautiful.
I would agree with you there. I mean, just to round this off, for those who've never seen Persepolis, what would you say to them just to encourage them to give it a go?
There is a sequence set to Iron Maiden.
That's the perfect answer. That's the perfect answer.
I think, yeah, because
you don't expect it at all.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think it's a very surprising depiction of a childhood. When you think, oh, a child growing up in Iran when oppression is kind of encroaching and there's war around the corner, you kind of think very austere, like kitchen sink drama, but it's very funny. It has a very delightful sort of mixtape sensibility to how it approaches music and pop culture. I think it's a lot more fun than maybe I've given it credit for.
Yeah, I the paradox remains. I mean, there's someone, it's spoiler light, but there's someone executed very, very early in the film. A little bit further down the line, we're talking about ABBA.
Yes. Yeah. It can turn around these things because I guess that's just part of its very humanistic perspective. Like, these things often happen in close proximity to each other.
Persepolis is available on the Studio Canal Presents channel on Prime Video, Apple TV Plus and ITVX. Kemble, before we let you go, though, can we just do one slight further dive into the Studio Canal catalogue? We ask all of our guests to come up with a double bill of recommendations. I'd imagine animation's going to be at least part of your double bill.
Yes, I went with a very... I don't know if I considered the thematic connection here very well, but I went with two animated... I went with two animated bears for this one. So people will probably be familiar with Paddington 2, which is a very... Yeah, probably maybe the most popular Studio Canal film that I can think of from the present day.
So you scored 1 out of 1 on the animated bear front so far.
So far. And then there's the French animated film Ernest and Celestine.
Oh.
Which got a sequel this past year, I believe. And it's about a little bear and mouse duo of musicians, one of which is also a criminal, and their sort of misadventures together. It's very sweet and very funny. Kind of connects back to Persepolis in a way in that it's all very traditional and hand-drawn. You kind of see the texture of it, all this like watercolor, very kind of loose and sketchy characters, and just very charming and funny. It's a great film, and Studio La Cachette, who produced it, have gone on to make some really incredible stuff since then. So it would be a dream double bill for me to put on for someone, being like, oh, you like funny cartoon bears, then let me show you this French cartoon.
Cavalier, are you an easy person to buy Christmas presents for?
No.
Does it just have to be like a moving bear and you're a happy man?
No, I've been told I have very esoteric tastes, so sometimes I just try and make things simple.
Cavalier Campbell, this has been an absolute delight. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Both Ernest and Celestine and Paddington 2 are available to watch on the Studio Canal Presents channel. Now it's time for our regular news update from the world of Studio Canal. Following its cinema run earlier this year, the delightful comedy drama Wicked Little Letters is heading to DVD and Blu-ray. Starring Olivia Colman, Jesse Buckley and a lot of swear words, the film arrives on disc on 13th of May. If you can't wait that long, the film is available to buy and rent on video on demand services right now. Go back 2 episodes and you can hear me talk about Michael Powell's stunning 1960 film, Peeping Tom, along with critic Lillian Crawford. Along with his equally legendary collaborator Emmerich Pressburger, Powell also co-directed a film that's landing on the Vintage Classics disc label. The Small Back Room may not be one of Powell and Pressburger's best-known films, yet the 1949 feature is a lesser-known gem, not least for David Farrar's terrific lead performance. It's arriving on DVD and Blu-ray, fully restored, on 3rd of June. A cinema release to add to your diary is the upcoming drama The Outrun. Starring Saoirse Ronan and Papa Essiadu, the film is based on the memoir of Amy Liptrot, and she co-wrote the script for it with its director, Nora Fingscheid. It follows a young woman who's just left rehab for alcoholism, heading home to the Orkney Islands, and it earned acclaim at this year's Sundance Film Festival. You'll be able to see it on the big screen from the 27th of September. Finally, just a reminder of 2 more cinema releases. Creature Feature Sting from Wormwood director Kia Roach-Turner arrives on the big screen on 31st of May as a small spider quickly grows to monstrous proportions with an appetite to match. Then, on 5th of July, attention turns to sharks as Something in the Water makes its cinema debut. Plenty to get your teeth into with those two. I'll be back soon with the next episode of Studio Canal Presents. Until the next time, to get all the news on Studio Canal films as it happens, and to find out more about the ITVX, Apple TV and Prime Video channels, you can visit www.studiocanal.co.uk or follow Studio Canal at Studio Canal UK on X, Instagram and TikTok. For now, I'm just off to practice an unusual rendition of ABBA's Dancing Queen. Until the next time, ta-ta for now.